Good evening. Welcome to Profiles. My name is Bob Willard, and I'll be your host today as we interview and spend some time with Morton Marcus.
You see what your anticipations are.
Well, okay. Now, Morton, I'm going to let you introduce yourself. You said you'd be glad to do it.
I'm Morton Marcus. I'm with the Kelly School of Business, and I'm the director of the Indiana Business Research Center. I've been teaching at the Kelly School, which wasn't the Kelly School when I started there, since 1970. And I consider myself on the staff at both Bloomington and Indianapolis and any other place in the state I happen to be, because I happen to think of this as the University of Indiana. Come on, Bob.
Okay, now that means...
Come on, jump in here anytime.
I'm going to jump in. I'm going to let you go. But if you say Indiana University or University of Indiana, then therefore you're encompassing the entire state as your student body.
Absolutely. As far as I'm concerned, I have about 5.5 million students, which is the largest class load of any member of the faculty. We have about 5.8, 5.9 million people in the state of Indiana, but there are about 300,000 to 400,000 who are from Purdue, and you can't reach them.
Oh, no. Wait a minute. Didn't you have a brother-in-law that taught up there or something?
No, I had a brother who taught there.
The brother who taught.
Yes, and got out as quickly as he could.
Okay. Let me ask with this kind of thinking. You have been here for, by my mathematics, almost 30 years.
That's 29 years.
29 yeah. years. You have no PhD.
That's right.
And you don't have tenure.
That's right.
Now, that's highly unusual. How have you managed to pull that one off?
I suspect I've been lost in the administrative records department somewhere.
And they can't find you?
Well, I think what has happened is that I serve a purpose that is useful to the university, and I've never brought any particular discredit on the university. And as long as I can serve that purpose effectively, and it is valuable to the university, they've been happy to keep me around. And after a while, you just don't get rid of people. You know how difficult it is to go through human resources and get rid of anyone. By the way, Bob, we have a wonderful medical school up in Indianapolis. What I do for the university, which is the question you ought to be asking at this point.
What do you do for the university?
Thank you. What I do for the university is pay attention to the state of Indiana. I try, with the excellent staff of the Indiana Business Research Center, to monitor the changes in the economy and population of our state and to provide information about those changes to the people of the state. And we do this through publications. We do this through presentations. Presentations in the form of lectures to fourth grade classes or lectures to business executives. Our staff travels the entire state. I don't think there's a single county or state road that I haven't driven on in 29 years. We'll be at a Rotary Club in Rockville, Indiana one day, and we'll be talking to members of the General Assembly on another day. And what we do is basically get information about Indiana to the people of Indiana through the press, through radio, through television. And this is a state that's rather exciting to be in because Indiana is one of the great, powerful industrial states of the nation that doesn't understand itself. It's a state that believes it's largely agricultural in nature. We've been dominated by propaganda out of Purdue into thinking that we're an agricultural state. We're basically a manufacturing state. Manufacturing is a very important part of the future of humanity. And I think that by helping the people of Indiana understand the nature of their state, we can do something useful. That's the job that I do for Indiana University, is bringing some of the knowledge of this university, which is a fine university and which is an international university and has many different interests. I bring some of that information to the people of Indiana. That's one of the things we should be doing if we're in any way believe President Brand's talk about being America's new public university. We've been practicing that policy since 1925 in the business school, because that's when the Business Research Center was formed.
But you don't feel that it's expanded to what it could be?
Well, nothing ever expands to what it could be. There's many more things that we could do as a university. There are many more things we could do in the School of Business to function on as a resource for the people of Indiana. There's a great deal we could do with radio and television, for example. to bring more information to people in Indiana. But choices have to be made in terms of the allocation of money and the time of people. I think that this university could be doing much more for Indiana. I think we could certainly be explaining much more of what's going on in our state and what's going on in the world much more directly to the people of Indiana through the use of television into the homes of everyone, and through the use of radio not only into the homes but right into the automobiles. There is no reason, in my view, that Indiana University should not have a statewide radio and television capacity so that we could put our instructional materials, our lectures, our conversations out on the air 24 hours a day. There are lectures being given on the Bloomington campus that could be televised live or on tape throughout the state. There is no reason that a person sitting in Hartford City, Indiana, should not be able to attend the lecture. This whole idea that education is provided only to the people who sit in front of the instructor in person is an idea that is archaic. As a university today, we should be providing education throughout the state. It doesn't have to be on a degree basis at all. We can say, we're giving this lecture. What's the marginal cost of providing that information to the rest of the state? As an economist, I can tell you that the marginal cost is relatively low once we build that network. And the network is largely built. As far as radio is concerned, I've often believed that this station, WFIU, should be basically a simulcast in the sense that it should be 100% talk and it should be 100% music. And that a mixture of the two may be pleasant, but it's only because it's limited. I think the music function is extremely important, and I think there ought to be a talk component. We need to have the members of the faculty of Indiana University talking with the people of the state of Indiana all day long. There's a lot of audio material that could be out there. And again, the same lecture that is given on television, you take the audio portion, you edit it appropriately for radio, and send it out there. 2 o'clock in the morning, I can assure you there are people who are awake and driving through the state of Indiana who will find some of this useful. And that's our purpose, to provide information. Bob, you better jump in here somewhere.
No, I'm just thinking about how much of an advocate for a good education for the entire public you are.
Well, naturally, that's our job. Our job is to provide education to the people of Indiana, not to the limited group that we call the enrolled students of this university. And people pay taxes. They might be even willing to pay more taxes if we provided more service.
You seem to have a strong sense of the value of education.
I'm an evangelical economist. Let's be serious.
Well,
my feeling is we've got to bring the message to the people of this state. There are large numbers of people on this campus who believe that this is a university that's located in Indiana. And I believe that this university exists because of the legislature and the Constitution of the state of Indiana. It is not by accident that we are in Indiana. It is by design. And those who would prefer for their own professional purposes to focus on matters that do not relate to and serve the people of the state of Indiana are working in the wrong place. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't have a very strong international and national presence. If we're going to have a fine university, we have to have those capabilities. But basically, we are in and of this state.
Now, with this sense of education, is all of your family into education, or are you unique?
Most of my family could read for many years, yes.
Well, you know what I mean. Are they?
No, I don't know what you mean. What do you mean, are they into education? My brother was a college teacher.
There's one. Okay.
He taught at Purdue. He taught at Michigan. He taught at Michigan State. That's as far as education as a profession goes in our family.
Okay. But your parents must have nurtured this kind of attitude.
I think that what my parents nurtured was a sense that we live in a society where you have to be conscious of other people. You have to recognize that what you do in life and the rewards that you get in life are based on your relationships with other people, that it's not isolated. And that's clearly what we teach in economics.
So you're giving forth what you feel strongly about and hoping to bring other people to expand their thinking and maybe take some risks. There seems to be some of that.
I don't know how much of a risk is involved. To me, risk is not necessarily the applicable word. I'd rather use the word duty, which is another four-letter word. I think we have a duty to ourselves and to others to be effective in terms of providing services to other people. This can be done through the private sector or through the public sector. It's not necessarily a religious point of view, but it is a moral point of view.
Well, that's quite a ways. That's quite a bit of thinking. Why don't we take a rest here so we can listen to some music, and then we'll come back and let me get my shoes back on after you've knocked me out of them a couple times here. What would you want to hear now that you've brought?
One of the things that I'd like to hear is a piece by Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson was a remarkable individual. He was one of the true heroes of the United States, a man of incredible gifts as an artist, as an athlete, and at the same time, a man who, as far as many Americans are concerned, discredited himself by his association with the Soviet Union when Stalin was really at his worst. And I think it's an example, in a way, of how idealism carried too far, and idealism rejected at home very often can result in turning to and becoming subject to the more sinister things, the things that are really against the fundamental idealism that's being expressed. So Paul Robeson is sort of an object lesson for us all, that even the greatest among us have the disappointment of not seeing our ideals accepted, and there is always a danger for all of us that we would turn seeking approval elsewhere in what amounts to an immoral direction.
So we have a selection from Paul Robeson.
That's one of the spirituals that Paul Robeson sang so well. I selected it because it was relatively short, and I knew that would fit your attention span.
Jeez, go sing me, will you? Okay, it's Go Down Moses, sung by Paul Robeson. Let's hear it.
Israel was in Egypt's land, let my people go. Oppressed so hard they could not stand, let my people go. Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt's land, tell
We have just heard the spiritual Go Down Moses, sung by Paul Robeson, a special selection of our guest, Morton Marcus. Now, we talked a little bit earlier about being a risk taker. I sort of feel like I've joined in those ranks being here and approaching Morton because he's quick. So I have a couple more questions of you. Let's go on from there. You use that humor in your lectures. How do you feel that helps enhance what you do?
I use humor in my lectures. I use humor in my writing. I write a column which appears in more than 30 newspapers across the state, including the Bloomington newspaper, the Bedford newspaper, and others. And I use humor largely as punctuation, as a way of helping people to listen to what I'm saying. When I look at an audience and I see them beginning to drift away, I will throw in some bit of humor. I try to get people's attention. I try to make sure that they have enough oxygen in their system because they're laughing. And oxygen goes to the brain, helps people to listen. Fundamentally, I think of myself as an educator, certainly not as a humorist by any means. Occasionally, I'm introduced that way, and I feel that it's detrimental to whatever I'm going to do, because if you're introduced as a humorist, people will sit there and say, go ahead, make me laugh. Mm-hmm. And that's not really
they expect Herb Schreiner or something.
That's right. Yeah. And I'm certainly not Herb Schreiner.
Okay.
That's right. I think Don Rickles is the one that I'm normally
okay. Well,
to.
I'll keep me on my toes now, yeah. But do the lectures come easy?
After 29 years, getting up in front of a group is relatively easy. I still have difficulties getting up in front of members of our faculty. My peers still scare me. They're very bright people. They're very demanding people. But by and large, I'm able to do that. The first time I got up in front of a class was a very difficult time. I can remember standing in the window looking out on 10th Street here in Bloomington. Students were coming into a class in urban economics, and my heart was thumping and pounding in my chest. And I had never taught at all when I was in the doctoral program at UCLA. So I stood there with all the anxiety of the first afternoon of teaching. And finally I said to myself, Indiana University is a wonderful school. They think you can do this. Who are you to doubt their good judgment? And with that degree of pat on the back from the university, I turned around and talked to the class, and I've been talking since.
Well, that's an interesting philosophy.
Well, it is. Yeah. It's a very important thing for people at Indiana to remember, should they forget it. And that is, this is a marvelous institution. And when I go anywhere in the state, I go really almost anywhere in the nation, and am introduced as coming from Indiana University, that gives me credibility whether I have it on my own or not. This university has an outstanding reputation. It's the responsibility of those who are here to maintain and enhance that reputation, because it gives us so much of a head start in our activities.
It's like a nice endorsement before you ever walk in the door.
That's right. It's wearing the Yankees uniform, which it hurts me to say because I grew up as a Dodgers fan.
Well, you're from Brooklyn, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm from Brooklyn, and we had very, very strong partisan feelings, and that's why I make jokes about Purdue. I really don't have too much against Purdue. I have enough against Purdue, but I use the IU-Purdue rivalry, shall we say, which is in the minds of many people in Indiana, and I don't use it out of state. It serves no purpose. But I use that rivalry as a way of, A, reinforcing my identification with Indiana University, and because in part people anticipate that IU and Purdue will have this rivalry. I have a good deal of respect for Purdue, and I feel that Purdue also doesn't do enough for the state of Indiana.
You said you're from Brooklyn, you've been to UCLA, and now you're in Bloomington. Could you sort of give us a little bit of your life story?
My life story? Well, I was born on a Friday early in November.
Brief history of your life.
I was born in November 1938 and left Brooklyn at age 15 to go to the University of Chicago without completing high school because the girls I was interested in at the time were interested in boys who were taking an early entrance exam, so I thought maybe I could get their attention. At age 15, that is the motivating factor, if not at the age of 55 or 65. So I went off to the University of Chicago. They threw me out within a year and a half because...
You were 16 and they threw you out already?
No, I was already 17.
Okay.
They did throw me out in March of 1956. I guess it was. And I went to work. They threw me out because I wasn't attending class and they wanted me to protect my record, as they say. I went to work for Cargill Incorporated downtown in the financial section of Chicago. Got married. My good wife encouraged me to get back into school. And I did and went to Roosevelt University downtown Chicago. Graduated from there, went to Washington University in St. Louis, largely because I couldn't think of anything better to do than so I went to graduate school. And then from Washington University, where I had the pleasure of being the first person ever to fail the master's exam, which is necessary to get into their PhD program. They told me that I should get out of economics at that point, just take a master's and leave. Well, I left and went to UCLA because the professor I was working with went to UCLA, and he was able to get me into UCLA because he came with money and I came with him. I was at UCLA, passed all my exams, interviewed at 16 different universities. Indiana University did not make the best offer, but they were the best university, so I came here with the full expectation by the university and by me that I would finish my degree. And that was 1970, and I've sort of stopped working on it by now.
Your PhD degree?
Yes.
After 29 years, you're still not working on it?
That's right. But the university still is very cognizant of the fact that I don't have a PhD, and they don't let me forget it. We have to remember that if you do not have a terminal degree within an academic institution, you have not been certified as being complete. If you have a terminal degree, it means that learning is over for you. See, I still have to learn. I've been basically in an academic institution since February of 1944 when I went into kindergarten, and they haven't let me out yet.
But you don't feel that this has any effect on your effectiveness? It doesn't seem to.
I think it has been a great motivating factor, an absolutely great motivating factor, to demonstrate that I can do things without a degree that might not be done otherwise.
You mentioned to me in private the importance of regulations, and yet you seem to flaunt the authority on occasions here. Am I reading that correctly?
I think regulation is important to make society run well. I think institutions very often show some degree of inflexibility in their behaviors. Let me give you an example. It would be very difficult for us to drive through the city of Bloomington without stop signs and traffic lights. Lane markings are very helpful also, although many people ignore them. Those are regulations. We regulate weights and measures. I wouldn't want to go into a gas station without having some kind of idea that I'm going to be getting a gallon of gasoline. When you go into the grocery store, you want to be sure that the things you're buying are reasonably safe to eat. That's regulation by government. I think that's most appropriate. When you come to institutional regulations, very often their purpose is to make the institution run more smoothly, and I'm not so sure that they're always designed for the best interests of all parties in that organization. I'm perfectly happy with the university doing what they've done, largely because I've been able to handle myself within that situation. But I wonder how much the university loses by having some of its concerns about making sure that all of the members of their faculty have advanced degrees. I think that we're beginning to move away from that. I think we're beginning to recognize that the concept of tenure and relating that to advanced degrees is not necessarily going to ensure that we have the best talent.
So then the importance, and maybe I'm reading beyond this, of a university is to expand out and not spend all its time looking on what's in. I don't know whether I'm making that clear.
Well, you're making it clear. I don't know that's really what the issue is. I think the university's job is what I call a COD organization. We're here to create, to organize, and to disseminate knowledge or information. We create knowledge through research, although many of the things that are called research do not create any knowledge at all, but that's basically the function of research, is to create knowledge. We organize knowledge through our lecture notes, through our writing of textbooks, through writing journal articles we can organize knowledge. That is, bring things together so that people can find it more useful, and then we disseminate knowledge. And the forms of dissemination are, as recognized by the university, basically twofold. One is you teach in a classroom, and secondly, you write. And for whom do you write? You write for your peers in the field. That's how we base promotion and tenure at the university in large measure, is on writing for those who are in your field. So if you're in finance, or if you're in the English department, or wherever you may be within the university, you write for your peers in your field, and they will determine by accepting your publications in their journals, in their better journals, whether or not you get promotion and tenure. It has nothing to do with whatever you're doing for the university and for the goals of the university. It's a question of what you're doing with regard to your field. That, I think, is a mistake that the university has. I believe that the dissemination of knowledge is an important activity, and it can be done in many ways. And I've tried to show some of the ways in which it can be done.
Why don't we take a break here, listen to some more music, and then I'd like to come back and touch on this subject a little
sure.
bit more. What would...
Well, let's listen now to a piece by Jim Robinson and some others from New Orleans. Jim Robinson's a trombonist, and you'll listen to this piece, and what you'll hear is all of the individual instruments. I like New Orleans jazz, particularly the older form of New Orleans jazz, of which this is a representation, where you can hear each instrument. You can hear the trombone, you can hear the clarinet or the trumpet if present, you can hear the bass, you can hear the drums, yet you also hear all of them together. And to me, that's what society should be. Society should be a place where each voice can be heard, and yet together they make music. The other reason I like this is because my single attempt at being a musician in life was to try to play the trombone. I spent 2 years trying to play the trombone and had no difficulty with the mechanics, but found I couldn't read music.
Well, that's a little makes it a little difficult.
It makes it difficult. Yeah.
Well, let's hear what Jim Robinson does with the trombone. We have just heard a selection by the trombonist Jim Robinson, and it's a selection of our guest today, Morton Marcus. You said you wanted to say a few more words.
Well, that piece is called You Pray for Me and I'll Pray for You, which I think is an excellent idea of the reciprocal relationships that have to exist in society. I am very concerned about people who pray for themselves and fail to think about praying for others as well.
Let's move on then. How about what are the four I's that you consider important?
Oh, the four I's. The four I's I developed in a talk I gave here on campus in the Union Building back probably in the early to mid-70s on a Saturday morning. And I was looking for a way to close my talk about what is the nature of the university. And I honestly don't remember what the group was that we were involved with. But I said that the university is known largely as a 4A institution. That is, you know, 4A's 4.0 average. That's considered the very best. That we're considered academic, which means irrelevant. You know, when Howard Cosell used to say on television, well, that's all academic. What does that mean? It means it's not relevant. And people say academic when they mean irrelevant. That's how we're known. We're known as being adversarial because the only time that university people seem to come out of the university is when they're against something. They're rarely seen as forces for something. They're seen as forces against something. Let's be against I-69. Let's be against something else. We're not seen as being people who are in favor of things. We're known for another A for athletics. I travel the state of Indiana. I have to keep up with Indiana sports. It would be criminal if I didn't know what happened to our basketball team and how many points AJ did or didn't score. That's gauche. Athletics are a very important part of these matters. And the final A, I think, could be acquisitive. The universities are seen, particularly by the legislature, as being aggressively acquisitive. They seem to want resources all the time, more resources, more resources. I'm not sure that any of those A's are correct, but what I was trying to suggest is that we, particularly at Indiana, should be known for the four I's. And the four I's are not the kind that are in our heads, but the letter I that represents Indiana. First, we provide information. That's what we do. We provide information to our students. We provide information to citizens of Indiana. We provide information to people throughout the world. We take that information and we organize it into ideas, coherent thoughts that help people understand the world and operate in the world. We also provide people with concepts that are ideals. They are those things in life that we aim for, as ideas that become, in effect, goals and targets. Those are the ideals of society. And universities are basically conservative institutions. We are here, I believe, to teach the ideals of society to our children. And we get into a lot of trouble very often because by upholding those ideals, we are seen as opposing current trends in society. We are seen as advocates, for example, for free speech. Free speech is one of the ideals of our society, but every now and then, the current tendency is to suppress free speech. So the universities, by upholding and by being conservative and standing by the ideals of our society, are somehow in opposition to the current times. And finally, I think the final I, in addition to imagination, ideas, and ideals, is inspiration. I think that the university, whether it be through the art department or the music department or the business school or the school of medicine, can, and I would even go further and say should, provide inspiration to the society in which we operate about where we can go as a society, what we can be. I think this is a very important function of a university, and I think Indiana University has done that reasonably well.
I was thinking as you were talking that one of the selections that you have made was Richard Dyer Bennett singing the Vicar of Bray.
Yes.
And I wondered if you could tell us why you selected that and we could play it.
Richard Dyer Bennett, of course, was a fine countertenor. And the Vicar of Bray is a humorous song about a man who holds his position in the church even though there are changes of administration. And, of course, it goes against many of the things I've just been saying. That, of course, fits with me fairly well at the same time, because I feel that one of the things that we have to learn to master is an ability to hold opposing ideas, even opposing role models, and yet continue to function well.
So should we listen to the Vicar of Bray with Richard Dyer Bennett?
In good King Charles's golden time, when loyalty no harm meant, a zealous high churchman was I, and so I gained preferment. To teach my flock I never missed, kings are by God appointed, and damned are those who dare resist or touch the Lord's anointed. And this is law that I'll maintain until my dying day, sir, that whatsoever king may reign, still I'll be the Vicar of Bray, sir. When Royal James possessed the crown and popery came in fashion, the penal laws I hooted down and read the Declaration.
We have just heard the song The Vicar of Bray as sung by Richard Dyer Bennett. It was a selection of our guest today, Morton Marcus. And I have to say that I have had recordings of Richard Dyer Bennett for 40-some years, and it's always nice to hear it. And thank you for making that selection.
Just shows that you're as out of date as I am.
Well, I mean, I'm a few months older, though.
That's true.
If you were to say, what are the most important things that you could pass on to, you know, like a philosophy or a code of ethics, what would those be?
To whom? See, that's one of the difficulties, is that we start talking about passing on a philosophy, a code of ethics. But certainly what I would talk to my grandchildren about is not what I would talk to members of our faculty about, because my grandchildren have much further to go than members of our faculty.
Let's talk about the grandchildren.
All right. I'm very fortunate to have a grandchild out in California, and then to have another three grandchildren by marriage in north of Indianapolis, north of Zionsville. And if I were to talk to them, I would talk about the importance of reading. Even though I don't read a great deal, I did read a great deal when I was younger. And I would talk about the importance of seeing that you are part of a larger system of life. One of the most important lessons I ever had was in the first grade in school. I can remember this very, very well. The teacher, name was Miss Newmark. She assigned each of us to a particular subject. My subject was to find out where does the water come from and where does it go. And I went home and I talked to my parents and turned on the faucet and looked at the drain, turned on the faucet and looked at the drain. That was good fun. And was amazed to learn largely from my father about the whole system that brought water to New York City. And then the system that takes that water away. And you realize as you're watching the water coming out of the faucet that you're just part of that system. You're not the central part of it. You're just part of it. To me, that's been a guiding thought for many, many years. I used to say to my children when we lived out on Morningside Drive in Park Ridge and we'd watch the rain coming down, and they couldn't play outside. And I'd say, see that rain? It's going into the ditch out in front of the house because, of course, Bloomington has no sidewalks. Bloomington doesn't have a good sewage system for storms, but it's beside the point. And I would say that rain is on its way to the Mississippi River. And then I'd take them in and I'd show them a map of how that rain was going to go into Jackson Creek and from there into Salt Creek and on into the White River and the Wabash River and the Ohio River and the Mississippi River and on down to New Orleans and the Gulf of Mexico to indicate how we're connected to the whole world. Well, you could take our car out onto Morningside Drive, I would tell them, and you can go anywhere on the North American continent and perhaps, if the roads are in good shape, right down to Tierra del Fuego, which is where I hope Interstate 69 goes someday. This sense of connectivity, I think, is very important. And I think it is part of America that we tend to understate. Because the essential aspect that most people think of with America is individualism, is the idea that I have a right to determine what I do with my money. And I get into lots of fights about this one. Because I say, no, you don't have a right to determine what you do with your money. You have to spend your money in a way that is responsible. Just because you earned it doesn't mean anything. People gave you that money because you did something of value for them. That's the reason you got the money. Now you have to do something with that money that is responsible. If you spend that money in an irresponsible fashion, the market will respond. Let me give you an example. People go to the store and they buy shoes for their children or grandchildren that have lights in the heels. What that does is it sends a signal to the manufacturers of shoes that we're happy to buy shoes with lights in the heels, maybe we can make something even more preposterous. Now, if you know little children, you know that they all sparkle and they don't need to have lights in their shoes to sparkle. We need to send signals to people who use resources, to people who make shoes, that we want to buy things that are responsible. And we are not trivial people. But Americans, and I see this everywhere as an economist, and people throughout the world spend money on momentary personal pleasures far beyond any thought of what does this mean, what kinds of signals are we sending to everyone else. So if there's a lesson, if there's a moral or a philosophy, it's that you as an individual are part of a larger system. And you have a responsibility within that system. And all of the good things that you have are a result of your doing something that is worthwhile. Unless, of course, you've inherited it. But then we have tax laws that make sure that doesn't happen too often.
So you would pass on this kind of thinking to your kids?
That's what I think.
Or your grandchildren.
That's right.
Just before we leave, can you tell us a little bit about your family?
My family. Now, do you want to go back to my family in terms of—
I don't need 10 generations back.
Okay, I'm just trying to get clarification here. I'm just following the lead of our president. I want to know what you're talking about.
Let's talk about the people who have lived under the same roof with you.
Okay, there was my mother and my father. My mother is still alive. She lives here in Bloomington in a hospitality house. She celebrated her 90th birthday recently. And my father passed away in 1965, quite some time ago. And my brother was 6.5 years older. His name was Philip Marcus. He was a sociologist. He was educated at graduate school at University of Chicago. And as I think I mentioned, he taught at Purdue, Michigan, and Michigan State. And he passed away around, it was 1986, so that's 13 years ago. My first wife, Donna, still resides here in Bloomington, and a very wonderful woman. And we had two children, Neil and Saul, who are still remembered by people who went to school with them here in Bloomington. Saul died in a car crash of unknown origin out by Griffey Lake in 1986, and he was missing for 3.5, 4.5 months from August to December in 86. So that was a very trying period of time. This community was remarkably supportive, and helped us greatly. It's one of the marks of Indiana University and of Bloomington that there is a sense of community here. And it shows up when there are difficulties of that sort. And we were very appreciative of that support. But the county commissioners still haven't put in any kind of guardrails at, did I say Griffey? I should have said Lake Lemon. It was Lake Lemon. And then subsequently, unfortunately, we were divorced and I moved to Indianapolis and remarried. And Rebecca and I have been living in Indianapolis for the last 10 years now.
Also. And that's your family.
Those are the people I've lived with. Now, I haven't told you about all the cats and dogs.
We can skip those, unless you need to. This is
important. And I think that dogs and cats are important as additional people. When I'm watching an IU basketball game and they're losing, those two dogs sitting on my lap give me comfort. And you need comfort in some fashion when you're watching an IU game and they come close to winning and then they fall back. You need help. You need assistance. You need a support group. And if there's no one else to sit around and drink beer with, sitting there with those dogs can be very meaningful. So don't dismiss them.
I'm not. Good. Well, this is maybe the most unusual ending we've ever had, is to talk about dogs and IU basketball. But this has been a very interesting time. You've kept me on my toes. I have enjoyed every minute of it. I've learned a lot.
Well, it doesn't say anything, however, about those who were listening and fell asleep.
Well, we'll get to those in a minute because we're going to. And I guess I hopefully speak for the audience that we've had today. We thank you so much for taking time to be with us.
It's a pleasure.
Let's end with one more selection, and that's from the Kindertotenlieder of Gustav Mahler. Could you tell us why you selected that?
I selected it largely because it's a beautiful piece of music. It's songs on the death of children, which has some, of course, some emotional meaning. To many of us, it's surprising how many people have lost children. Although it is a very painful situation, it is not an uncommon situation by any means, as we found out from wonderful letters and cards from so many people. But it's Marian Anderson, again, one of the great voices and one of the great stories of America. And her concert on the steps of Lincoln Memorial in Washington is one of those defining moments in American history, when Eleanor Roosevelt stepped in and others had said she could not sing in an auditorium in Washington. And these are the kinds of things we ought to remember in our country, that we are all the descendants of despised people. There's not a person in America who is not the descendant of someone who at some point of time belonged to a group that was despised, whether it was Irish or Welsh or Catholic or Protestant or Jew or Muslim, whether you come from Poland or Hungary or Italy, whether you're Native American, whether you're Hispanic or African American, it doesn't matter what your background is. You are the child of despised people. And yet there is a voice like Marian Anderson's to remind us of the prevailing humanity that we all have to respect.
We couldn't ask for a better ending. Our guest today has been Morton Marcus, the director of the Indiana Business Research Center here in Bloomington and a member of the faculty at the Kelley School of Business. Morton, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in January of 1999. Production assistance came from Michael Paskash and Christina Kuzmich. For WFIU, thanks for listening.